you know, or what if they think I'm divulging too much information all at once and it seems like I'm hungry to know them? So I think ultimately, like, I think what helped us the most, I don't know if you agree with this or not, but I just threw my hands up and went, Lord, I'm so excited about what you're doing. But I knew the day that Alicia gave me her real address, I had passed the test.
Yes.
That was a big deal.
It was a big deal. It really was.
It was a big deal.
Well, and I had to trust that she wouldn't give it to Christy. I mean, that was our main
Who are you?
Fear. Like, you know, we both had this love for Christy, but it was from very different perspectives, I guess. You know, like, that's her sister. I loved this woman that made my dreams come true and is, you know, the biological mother of my child. Like, I wouldn't be a mom or have Sayla without her.
Welcome everyone to Bringing Kids Home, a TPHC foster care and adoption production. I'm Kristen, TPHC Executive Outreach Manager. We are excited you are joining us today to hear stories of adoption and how any one of us, including you, can make a difference in a child's life. Today's podcast is sponsored by Linebarger Attorneys at Law. Linebarger believes in being strong corporate citizens in the communities where they work and live. Find out more at lgbs.com. We are grateful to Linebarger Attorneys at Law for supporting today's stories. Now stick around and hear how stories of faith and family help bring kids home.
Hi everyone, I'm Jason Curry, president of TBHC Foster Care and Adoption. I'm so glad you're with us. My guest today is Alicia Woodall and Dana Stinson. Alicia grew up in Texas, where she currently lives, and Dana grew up in California. Alicia is the creative marketing director for First Look in Waxahachie. They join us today united by the love of Jesus and their love for Alicia's adoptive daughter, Sayla. Each are sharing a story of how family is always big enough for adoption. Her story is one of redemption and God's gracious gifts. They join the podcast today because they want resources to be available and a way to share that God is surprising in his blessings, even in the face of loss. Y'all, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you.
Well, let me just kind of jump into a first little question here. Share about your journey of becoming family.
Yeah, so I did not contact Sayla's birth family until, I guess she was like 3. And so, yeah, we spent like a year on, you know, just getting to know each other on the phone. I first talked to Sayla's birth grandparents, and then I found out that there was a sister close to my age and my husband's age. And so then we got to talk on the phone. And the first time we talked on the phone, we talked for like over 2 hours, and just, it was easy, instantly clicked. And then we continued talking for, you know, off and on that year. And I just couldn't wait to meet them. And so, so now we've had 2 vacations with our new family, and it's just been more than I would ever expect or imagine. It's been great.
Yeah, I agree. I think the first year of chatting, even that first conversation that we had, it was so easy. It was, there was this eagerness on both of our parts and this ease in just in relating to one another. And yet there was also this huge guard that we both had, because we didn't know the other people. We didn't know who the other one was and if they were safe, and if they would put the child's needs first, and if we had no idea of really knowing who the other was. And so it took a long time. It was, you know, we stretched things out. We had a lot of conversation, but even from the first conversation, even though we had those safeguards in place, both of us, it was just so obvious that we were already friends. Like, we understood, and as we had, you know, value conversations and God conversations and pain conversations, yeah, we just had so much in common. And the biggest priority in those conversations for both of us always was just our love for Alicia's little girl, our love for her, and our and her importance and her safety and her success in life. And so it was pretty magical for me. There's like a huge slang saying right now, this is happening, right? Yeah. And that's how it felt. It was like, this is happening. This is happening. Like, is there another shoe that's going to drop? There have been a lot of shoes in the past few decades that have dropped. And the other shoe didn't drop. I mean, I might find out she doesn't, you know, like chocolate or something devastating. But other than that, it was just an amazing unfolding. And then you added the husbands in and my kids, and mm-hmm. it just got better and better and better. It was truly a miracle.
Mm-hmm. That's really cool. So as we get into this, I know we're going to explore that relationship more, but thank you guys so much for joining me today. I know this is a really special podcast because we're talking about the birth family, extended family, really just embracing adoptive family and vice versa. So it's a beautiful God story. So I'm excited to explore that with y'all today. So tell us your Bringing Kids Home story.
Yeah, so I would say, like most people, Cameron and I like always thought adoption would be a part of our family, but for whatever reason, it seems like most people, they think they'll have their biological children first and then adopt. I have no idea why that's a thing. But that's kind of where we were at. And then whenever we were ready to start our family, we quickly ran into infertility issues. And so we eventually came to the crossroads of, do we want to do in vitro? And our church is actually Stonegate in Midlothian. They're super like supportive of adoption. And so they had an adoption Sunday, they had a sermon, and the timing was all the Lord. And I would say that sermon like got us really thinking about our decision. And so we chose the adoption route instead of in vitro. And man, I would even say that anyone who's going through infertility, like you don't have to go through infertility treatment. You can go straight to adoption. Because that was another thing. For some reason, I just assumed like that's what you do. You have trouble getting pregnant, then you go to the doctors and you do all the tests and the pokes and the prods. And but I wish I would have gone straight to adoption. But again, the Lord's timing and you know, Selah's our daughter. So anyways, so that's how we got to that. We went through an adoption agency in California. And that was even a God thing, how we even found this adoption attorney in California. Their family building, Ted Yeomans is his name. But we actually had our profile show 9 times before. And so we had 9 no's, like, no, they chose another family or decided to parent or whatever. And that's super, super hard. And I guess after that 9th time, me and God had a real honest conversation. And I told him, I can't handle this anymore. Please, I just can't. I don't want to hear from the attorneys again until it is our turn, until it's her. And lo and behold, number 10, the 10th call was Selah. And even like bringing her home, that's a whole story in itself. But it was a whirlwind day. We flew to California and we got to meet her birth mom in prison. And that was a really special moment too. We were all crying. All 3 of us were crying in the first like 15 seconds of getting to meet each other. And something I never expected for the birth mom to say is, like she showed me empathy. She's like, so you've been married for 6 years and you haven't been able to get pregnant. And I said, no. And she goes, wow, that must be so hard. And I just started crying again. I just never expected to receive empathy from her. And it was like her and I couldn't thank each other enough. She said, thank you for doing what I can't do right now. And I said, well, thank you for making my dreams come true to become a mom. And so that was really special. And yeah, so then later that night, after some more ups and downs. Like I said, it's a long story, her just bringing her home. But yeah, we finally got to pick up our baby girl, and I have this sweet picture that I hang in Selah's room. And even though she's only 15 days, like, she is locked on eye contact with me. And it's just a really sweet picture. And so yeah, and then we flew home after the, I forget what it's called, ICPC or something went through, so you can leave the state. So we brought her back home to Texas. And when we came to the airport, we had a whole entourage party of banners and balloons and video cameras. And yeah, that was really special. And so, yeah, that's the short version. It may not seem like it, but that's the short version.
Most families probably never would experience the process of having to go into a prison and pick up their child and those kinds of things. Was there anything about that that you think would help someone if they were ever to face that, to know?
I mean, yeah, I had never been in a prison before or visited, you know, an inmate. I don't know. I mean, I was definitely nervous, but, you know, I could tell that she was nervous too. And it was kind of like, the atmosphere just kind of disappeared, and I kind of forgot that we were speaking between glass on like one of the payphones. Like it just kind of, because especially the moment was so, I mean, that's something I will never forget. I mean, that's like once in a lifetime, like, you know. And so even whenever I picture it, and I think more in feeling sometimes than visuals. I don't know. It's like that all faded away, and I was just able to connect with her and talk with her, and I didn't even know where I was.
Well, what you're doing there is so much more important than where it happens.
Right.
I mean, you could be anywhere. Mm-hmm. And it wouldn't matter because you're bringing your baby home.
Exactly.
You know?
That's really cool. The point of the story, I guess, is that the human experience is really what we're talking about. Relationship. All of a sudden, it doesn't matter where, it doesn't matter when. That's really neat. That whole process, I'm sure there's a lot to share there, but one detail I'll ask, and then we can kind of go to the next part of your story. But what was the most emotional or the greatest lesson that you learned from that process?
I guess I would say, like, going through just my desire and my begging God to let me become a mother, that was like the biggest suffering I've ever had. And I would say, I didn't realize it, but before then, I think I almost saw God as like this sweet old man in a wheelchair in a nursing home. And whenever you wanted to go visit him, he was there, and he'd always give you a lollipop and a smile and pat you on the head, and just a really sweet old man. And that sounds so condescending now, like hearing that, but I think that's the best visual I can think of, is like how I kind of thought of God. And so to like experience like, oh, he's not giving me what I want when I want it, and this is really hard, and this is like the core of, you know, being a woman and not being able to become pregnant. Like, that's like the core of your identity sometimes as a woman, you know, for some women. And so yeah, I would say my depth with my, you know, relationship with the Lord became so much deeper. And so like I said, like, we had some real honest conversations. Like, I was really mad at God, and I let him know it. And, you know, and some people may think, oh, you know, how dare you? But I feel like our relationship with God, it's a real relationship. And we had some conflict, and I was honest with him about my feelings. And so I feel like I just know him better now. Yeah, I'm trying to think of a new visual, and I don't know that I can do it like the old man, but he's definitely not an old weak man in a wheelchair there to give me everything at my whim, you know? So yeah, I had to trust him. I had to experience long suffering and even, you know, my husband and I, like, you know, men don't have that same biological, I don't know. It's just different because the men don't carry the child. And so even like, you know, my husband trying to comfort me and understand it, you know, it's just impossible really. So yeah, it, I know the Lord better, I guess is the answer. Mm-hmm.
Is it kind of like when you're growing up and you figure out that your parents, you know, when you're very little and you see your parents these sort of categorical figures in your life, as opposed to real people mm-hmm. with real problems and real hypocrisy and real mistakes and real triumphs. And then it's like, as you grow up and you see them, or you get an opportunity to see them for who they really are, and the Lord is the same, like you go, oh, you're not a construct of what I project onto you. You actually have your own thing going, God. Mm-hmm. And you're mm-hmm. actually who you are apart from my impression of it mm-hmm. and my feelings about it. And I mean, yeah. It's not like God changed.
No.
At all.
No.
During this time. It's us.
Yeah.
We're the ones who've been stretched and the ones who've been, had our eyes opened. Mm-hmm. And I understand that you get to know God better mm-hmm. and you realize how deeply your values don't actually match his and how far away you really are from being conformed
right
to his image, and not in a shameful, oh, we're so sinful and messed up way. We are, but not in that, just in a childlike way.
Yeah.
In the same way that, you know, your 5-year-old daughter just doesn't really understand how to do her income taxes. She's just not there yet. You know? Right. Yeah. Anyway. So I think I understand what you're talking about mm-hmm. is and pain, unfortunately, because we are who we are as humans. Pain is usually the method of awakening for that. Mm-hmm. And the refiner's fire is really the only way.
Right.
But, yeah, powerful but, lessons.
Yeah.
We've brought her home and you've had this big entourage waiting for you. Just celebrating's happening everywhere. So what's next in the story?
So then we're first time parents. And, you know, so that's a challenge in itself. I mean, you know, just figuring out. I remember the first night, you know, we were still in California. And Cameron and I had done, you know, some babysitting and I had lots of little cousins. And so, you know, I had experience with babies, not, you know, a ton, but we actually served in our church nursery. And that was like the best thing for Cameron because he's the baby of the family. And so, me and, you know, he learned how to bottle feed and burp a baby and swaddle him and, you know. And so that was really sweet to see him like, I mean, he's a super dad and it was super intentional about, okay, I gotta figure out this baby thing. But anyways, the first night, we didn't know that like infants breathe kind of like funny, like, and so, she's like laying in this little, like, you know, bassinet thing. And, we're just staring at her like, is she okay? Why is she breathing so fast? And anytime we tell people, you know, that they're like, oh, new parents, you're so cute. So yeah, I mean, I guess that, you know, that I have tons of pictures that week that we were in California waiting to be able to leave of, you know, Sayla's asleep on Cameron or asleep on me, or, you know, we just normal infant newborn life, you know, we were figuring it out. So
a new family member into the family. And I always love to say when we brought kids into our home, that we didn't know they were missing. They were always supposed to be a part of the family. So really, really need to complete a picture that God has already got in his mind. Mm. What about your journey with the Lord? Let me yeah. go back to that real quick. But God yeah. has now given you the desire of your heart, if you will.
Yeah. So I would say it's not, I kind of had some distrust of him. It was weird because like here he finally answered my prayers and I feel like, you know, I was that that parable of the woman who just begged and begged and begged and begged, and you know, and the bad judge was like, okay, I'll give you what you want. And, you know, and the Lord's like, well, you know, if this bad judge does that, how much more will the Lord, you know? That was probably a terrible paraphrase, but so I was super thankful, but I almost feel like I was careful too, like, oh, your will can be painful. And mm-hmm. so, and I would say, you know, even to this day, like, and this, you know, this may be helpful for lots of adoptive moms. Like, I really have to preach to myself the gospel in that, I catch myself thinking like somehow my begging, like convinced the Lord to let me become a mom. Like he finally gave in and was like, okay, I'll let you be a mom.
You earned it with your begging.
Yeah. Which I know is total wrong thinking, but, or like, okay, well I owe him, I have a debt to him because he gave me this precious gift and she is amazing. And, you know, and all those other 9 children, you know, that I prayed for and I begged him that those were my children and they weren't. Now it's like, well, I don't want any of them. I want Selah, you know? And so as an adoptive mom, I just feel like that's kind of my biggest struggle in my relationship with him through the angle of my relationship with Selah, I guess, is that I have to constantly, like, this isn't like I have to pay him back. This isn't like he's waiting for me to like, all right, I gave you this gift. How are you going to handle it? Are you going to take care of it? Are you going to do a good job? And I don't know if I hope other adoptive moms can relate to that and it helps them feel like, okay, that's normal. Or maybe I'm not normal. I don't know.
You're
but
normal.
That's definitely,
you're one of the kinds of normal.
One of the kinds. Yeah. Yeah. So,
yeah. No. Yeah,
that's cool. Well, let's go into, like, you know, next steps here, because I know you guys, we haven't even touched y'all's relationship.
Yeah.
But I guess one more kind of question, even to kind of get into that, how do we come to a place of willingness to contact mm-hmm. birth family? Because you know, let's talk very openly about it. There's a fear in contacting birth family a lot of times. And I know on your side, Dana, you have a similar perspective, right? Yeah. But how did you get to a place where you were prepared to and ready to and willing to? Because that's the journey a lot of people are on in that process for you. And so, Alicia, how did you get to the place you were ready to reach out? And then I want to hear from you, Dana, on that too.
Okay. So we actually were contacted when Selah was 21 months, that Christy, I don't think we've said her name yet, but was in labor with another daughter, and she wanted us to adopt now Selah's half-sister. And so this was like totally out of left field. We had no idea she was pregnant. No, you know, and so we had to make a decision in like a day. And so we said yes. And I flew out to California by myself to go and bring home Selah's sister is what I was thinking. And unfortunately, what Christy had told me about the father of this new baby was not true. And he didn't know anything about me or that they were, you know, she was talking to me about adoption. And so it was a failed adoption. And that child is being raised by her father. And so that was devastating. Mm-hmm. And so I went home empty-handed. It wasn't something I feel like God asked us to say yes. And we took a step of faith and said yes, and then I do it, and then he says no. But I will say that my time in the hospital, I have never, because I was so anxious. I was there by myself. I didn't have any friends, family. I mean, I was doing it by myself. And I did get to meet Christy again because she was in the hospital. And it was actually her birthday, her 35th birthday. And that was an answer to prayer in itself, because I've wanted to have a relationship with her, but it had just been through letters. And so to get to talk to her and show her videos of Selah, and I even got to pray with her in the hospital, that was an answer to prayer, like on her birthday too. Like, that was pretty special. But anyways, I just, like, from the person I sat next to on the plane, I got to tell about God to the nurses and the CPS workers. I mean, it was just like, I don't know. I've just never, it's like that mountaintop experience. Like, I literally felt the presence of the Lord that entire trip. Like, I've never felt so close to him. Like, he was holding me up, giving me the words, giving me the strength to keep going. I don't know why he said no ultimately about adopting her sister, but I guess to get back to your original question, sorry. I came home, and so that year, I had no closure. And so finally, like, my last resort was to reach out to Selah's, you know, biological grandparents. I thought maybe they might have some answers, but I was hesitant to do that because I didn't know what kind of people they would be. I didn't know if they're people I wanted in my life or not, but I needed that closure so bad that it was worth the risk. And I knew, you know, eventually we would want to have that relationship for Selah and want to investigate that. It was earlier probably than we would have chosen without her sister's situation. But so that's what led to reaching out to them, was to try to find answers out about the little sister.
Yeah. And I would say what was going on, same time, different location with us, just to give a little bit of background. It's just Christy and I are the two kids in the family, and my two parents and our two parents. And Christy has had drug addiction and other terrible things in her life. In our lives since she was 14 and I was 17. So she's a long-term addict, and she's been in and out of jail many times. And there's a lot of pain and a lot of hope, and then more pain, and then hope, and then more pain involved in that story. And for my position in it, I'm the older sister. So I'm not the parent. I don't get to decide what's done about her behavior when she's a child, when she's a teenager, when she's a 20-something, a 30-something doing these behaviors. I'm just in the family and living in it with no power and no say and very little influence, because I too am a kid going through and growing in all of this. And so I think for me thematically, it's important to say that I didn't realize it at the time, but I had a lot of helplessness in that kind of loss, because when you have a sibling who's addicted to drugs and the parents are trying, they're just laying themselves down, trying everything they can to help that distressed child. As the kid who's not in that kind, that level of distress, certainly had my own distress. I'm just a human person. But you just kind of go along and try not to make things worse. And part of the redemption of all the way fast forward to just that it is found in my relationship with Alicia and Cameron and Selah is that there's been loss, like, from the very beginning. Because when someone you love's on drugs, it's like they die over and over and over again. And they don't, not physical death, but that is different and much more final. But it's like who they are dies every time they go back out. And then they come back and maybe they get sober a little bit. And then there's this sort of rebirth. They're not the same as they were. But positionally they're in your life again and you have that loved one back and you'll take whatever version you can get because you just want them to be alive and you want to love them. And then they go back out and it's like who they were then, that round dies again. And they're still alive. I'm acquainted with real loss, real death. And it's not the same, but it is a kind of loss. It's a kind of death. And it's very helpless feeling. You feel very helpless when you're subject to it because there isn't anything that you can do. And I think I'm not an adoptive parent, but I think I have empathy for adoptive parents in this way that, and certainly relatives surrounding adoptive parents, adoptive families, that it feels, in a way, faith is your only practical option. Because it's so far out of your control. There are so many factors and so many moving parts and pieces and people and decisions and whims sometimes that just turn the trajectory of the whole thing in a completely different direction. And so what are you to do but say, I am certainly not in charge of this. I can't control if my sister is going to use drugs. I can't save her. I can't even accept her that way because she's too dangerous to accept that behavior and try to love her. I literally have to lose her because it's the only safe option for her and for me and for the people around me. So that background to say that we fast forward, and I think I didn't really feel how helpless I really was because I'm strong-willed and ambitious and kind of just decide like, okay, well, that's the goal. Let's just go get it. It's okay if it takes a while. Let's go get it. So I think I didn't really let myself feel that level of loss until later when Christy started having children and I started having children. And there were these helpless, innocent, precious gifts from God that I again was not positionally in a place to protect or even to do something, you know, really shallow, like send birthday cards, you know, like I couldn't even do that. Selah's not her first child. And so as we had children, my husband and I had three children, and the middle child died when she was 7 weeks old. She was full term. She was born and she died. And about the same time, Christy made contact, which she did in and out. Sometimes she would be in jail and I would go and visit her. Sometimes she would be in jail and I wouldn't go and visit her. Sometimes she would be sober for, you know, a hot minute and we would have contact. Sometimes, you know, it's in and out. And people who have substance abuse in their families don't need any more explanation than that. And people who don't have substance abuse in their families should just talk to their friends because they know someone who has it. But around that same time that I was pregnant with my daughter, my middle child who died, Christy contacted me again and she was, oh, I'm pregnant and I'm going to keep the baby, et cetera, things like that. And I didn't tell her that I was pregnant with a baby who I knew would probably die maybe today. Maybe minutes after she was born, maybe weeks, I didn't know. Because there was no point in telling her that. But I remember having that same wrestling match with God. Like, and I think because my upbringing was the way it was, I didn't have this sense of like, he's going to give it to me. Mm. I didn't have that feeling. I knew God owes me nothing. He owes me nothing. And positionally, I'm the servant, I'm the follower, I'm the disciple. And I don't mean that in a less than sort of a way, in a less valuable sort of a way. I mean it in a positional way, you know? And so I didn't, you know, even when we learned that our middle child was, she had trisomy 18, even when we learned she had this and she would likely die and she would die from this, I didn't feel like, this anger toward God about like, well, that's not fair. I felt like, okay, I just begged God, please, I don't want to do this. I don't want this to be the road. And then, so, and God just said, I've prepared you for this and you're not going to walk alone. This is the road, you know?
Hi, I'm Laurie Henthorne, Donor Engagement Manager at TBHC Foster Care and Adoption. Did you know that there are over 6,000 children waiting for adoption in Texas today? And did you know that there are only about 1,000 willing foster adoptive homes licensed and available to them? These children are coming from hard places and are needing a place to heal. We at TBHC strive to provide homes where they'll feel safe and loved and where they can begin their healing process. What if you could play a part in changing these statistics? TBHC depends on people like you to help change the course of these children's lives. You could open your heart and home to them, or you could come alongside them and help provide for the parents' training or for specialized therapy for a child through your financial support. We invite you to visit our website, tbhc.org, to find out more about us, hear inspiring stories and ways to pray for TBHC families, and to find out how you can be a part of bringing kids home.
And then, so, and God just said, I've prepared you for this and you're not going to walk alone. This is the road, you know? And I knew that I could trust what he was telling me. I just didn't like what he was telling me. Mm-hmm. And so all of that's going on when Christy calls with her second child. Selah's her third. And I'm going, okay, God, why are you giving my sister, right? Why are you giving her baby after baby, uncomplicated births and she doesn't even want them, so there was a juxtaposition there of like, if I didn't know God as well as I did at that point, I would think he was rubbing it in, like, you know, because it's so personal. Mm-hmm. You can't help but feel personal about it. You can't help but feel self-centered about it. Like, it's about you. It's something between you and God. And so I just want to encourage other people to remember that it's not all about you, and it's not between, God's not trying to send you a message with every painful thing or joyful thing that happens in your life, unless that message is you need God. That's it. And that's true whether the message is aimed at you or at someone else and you just hear about it. So fast forward to now, Christy's third child is born, and thank you, God, she's born in jail, because we know she's likely sober. We know the baby is safe, and we hear through the grapevine, because we don't have direct contact, that she's placing this baby for adoption. And I still to this day think it's the best thing she's ever done in her life. And the most selfless thing she's ever done in her life. And we know we're not gonna, my parents and I and my husband and our then two kids, we know we're not going to have contact with those children unless they call us and want to. There's again, positionally, no power that I can exercise in order to love these people. I just have to sit and wait for them to give me permission to do it and an opportunity to do it. So when Selah goes home with Cameron and Alicia, we don't know them. We just hear, oh, there's a couple in Texas. And then we just pray. We just pray and pray that they're good people, that they're gonna love her and a fraction of the amount that we love her. Because I know, at least up to that point, all of Christy's children have been unavailable to me to adopt. And even if I could have adopted them, I wouldn't have been able to, because it would have been too dangerous for me to open my home up to my sister's child when she's a known meth addict who's unpredictable, and the list of things that meth addicts are. And my first priority has to be to protect my children that God has already given to me, and that it's just simply not my job. And to be able to trust God, to have the task of trusting God to care for something that you care about more than yourself is so difficult. And it makes me think of the cross, because that's exactly what God had to do with his son. And what's worse is God knew that his son would be abused the whole time, you know, and die painfully, and he still did it. So I feel like if God can do it, so can I. Selah is God's child, not mine. That my daughter Olivia, who died, is God's child, not mine. And my two children, my two daughters who are alive, they do not belong to me. They belong to God. So fast forward to now Brooke, the fourth child, is born. And my parents have gotten wind of this. So I've gotten wind of this. And we're not really sure. We hear weird rumors. And it's not because we want to rely on rumors. It's because that's the only information that we have available to us in this situation. And my parents go to the hospital. They hear that she's in the NICU. They hear that maybe the parents who adopted Selah, maybe they're going to adopt her. They're not sure. My mom still swears she thinks she saw you in the NICU that day. We didn't know what one another looked like, that kind of thing, when she was trying to visit and just trying to see. But ultimately, it was out of our hands. Mm-hmm. And the bio dad stepped in and said, "What are you talking about? You're going to place my child for adoption." Mm-hmm. And that fell through and everybody went home. But then we knew, okay, these people in Texas who have adopted Selah, they care. They want to adopt her sibling. There's something about them that bodes well for Selah and just the kind of people that they might be. But again, we didn't get to contact them. We had no way of doing that. So anyway, then when Alicia did contact my parents, it was this immediate, yes, please. Yes. And then to get back to what you were talking about earlier, just that fear of contacting the birth family. The fear is reciprocated by, if the birth family is worth knowing, they're afraid too. They don't know the circumstances, I bet. And in many cases, they don't know the circumstances of the adoption. They don't know who you are. They don't know. They don't want to jeopardize the child by being more closely tied to the birth parents that may be extremely dangerous and unpredictable. All the way up to just like maybe the birth parents aren't extremely dangerous and unpredictable, but it would just be emotionally full of duress for everyone to have that contact. I mean, you just don't know.
Right.
And since the priority is the protection of the children on all sides, not just Selah, but my children as well, there's this tentativeness that, it's really fear is what's behind it. But behind the fear is just the love and the desire to protect. Mm-hmm. So when we started talking, it was eager and slow. And we wanted to volunteer all of this information so as to convey our character to one another. And at the same time, didn't want to volunteer any information to one another, because what if they're a psychopath? You don't know, you know, or what if they think I'm divulging too much information all at once and it seems like I'm hungry to know them? And then that seems like, so I think ultimately, I think what helped us the most, I don't know if you agree with this or not, but I just threw my hands up and went, "Lord, I'm so excited about what you're doing. But it's not a sprint. I trust you. Let's, you know, like, please help this to unfold, you know, peacefully and naturally, and just like keep us moving along what path needs to be moved on, you know." But I knew the day that Alicia gave me her real address, I had passed the test.
Yes.
That was a big deal.
It was a big deal. It was a big deal. Well, and I had to trust that she wouldn't give it to Christy. I mean, that was our main
Who are you?
Fear, like, do you understand, you know, and she understood. And I feel like too, we bonded over, you know, we both had this love for Christy, but it was from very different perspectives, I guess, you know, like that's her sister, that she's, you know, grew up with and has lost, you know. And then I think I'm like a optimist. And so, you know, when I went into adoption, I thought, oh, I want to have an open adoption and have a relationship with the birth mom. And I don't know, like all these, like, just be friends. And I don't know what, I just wanted open relationship. And so I didn't get that, but yet, like, I loved this woman that made my dreams come true and is, you know, the biological mother of my child. Like, I wouldn't be a mom or have Sayla without her. And just want good things for her so bad. I want her to be sober. I want her to have a wonderful life. I want her, you know. And man, I don't know that I've prayed for anybody actually more than I've prayed for Christy. I would have dreams about her. And and so
to, I mean, I relate to that a lot.
Right. No, yeah. I know.
Yeah.
But that was like a thread too. Like I don't even begin to have the depth of pain that Dana has, but it was like someone else that like loves Christy, you know, and I love Christy, and it's totally, again, two different perspectives, but it was like someone I could talk to about like this. Again, I've only met her twice in my life, but I don't know. There's just, I don't know her. I love her. She is the mother of my child.
Yeah.
And I just beg God to rescue her from herself, you know?
And I think our influence on one another has been so beneficial, because I came into that and looking at her and having her say all these things about optimism and close relationship with Christy. And I'm going, okay, I need to give you a little reality check. Like, yeah. This is the reality of the circumstances of her life and her choices. And you need to be careful. You need to be careful. You need to not give her any money. She's like, oh, I know. And I was like, but do you? I didn't know. So I'm trying to temper her in her zeal and in her Christ love for Christy and her gratefulness to Christy for Sayla. And then similarly, she is reminding me not of the like deep desire and hope in Christ I have for her, for Christy's redemption and restoration into our family, but of the feeling of it, the feeling. Like, I'll always pray for it, I always do, but there's that when you suffer for a long time with the same kind of pain, you naturally become calloused. And it's not an unfeeling or rejecting or hopeless kind of callous. It's literally just the result of work over a long period of time. And so even though in your head and in your prayers, you're praying for these things that Alicia was just talking about, like a child would talk about it, so full of hope and so uninjured by it. When to hear her talk about it and to hear her pray about it, it reminded me of the true feeling of that hope, like the refreshing feeling of it. Mm. Like when you've been a Christian for a really long time and then you go on a retreat and you're like, but I love Jesus, but he's so good to me. And you're just full of just like fire and passion, and all because you spent a weekend singing in the woods. And that was kind of like what it was like. It was kind of like what it was like to meet Alicia, where I just remembered, like, I allowed myself through her eyes to remember how much I love Christy and how wonderful she is and how much God loves her in a way that was both very painful and very hopeful, very fresh. And I think the pain is super unpleasant. I mean, I think everyone can agree about that. Pain is so unpleasant, but it's important to allow yourself to feel it again sometimes, especially in a long journey like adoption can be. like substance abuse is, like the loss of a child is, whether she dies or whether the adoption gets pulled. It's not just acceptable. I think it's important to allow yourself to come back and revisit that pain in the arms of hope. And I think Alicia's relationship with me has helped me be able to do that in a way that doesn't leave me depressed for 4 days about it. It's like, okay, and we're all together and we're all doing it together. And there's my two daughters who are still alive, and there's Sayla. And by the way, God has got all the other kids that are not in our care right now.
Yeah. Wow, guys. Anyway. So, you know, this story y'all are sharing today, you know, it's about Sayla, but it's more about Christy and the unity that has brought y'all together centers on her and her struggles, her pain, some of the shame that we easily feel. And I'm overwhelmed, number one, because God will use anything and redeem anyone to tell his story the way he wants to. And that's what she is in this story. She is a part of the redemption for everyone. I'm just blown away by it. When we look at the relationship that you guys are able to enjoy now, what would you say has been maybe one of the hardest things, and maybe it was the time that it took y'all to build it, and what was one of the easiest things in this relationship between you two?
I would say the hardest thing for me is I feel like it's harder for adults to make friends than kids sometimes, but we still have that I think, do they really like us? Do they really want to have a relationship with us? Like, are they just being nice to us? Do they really, you know? And so like having those doubts, like we want this more than they do. I would say like that's been the hardest thing, which I'm like, well, that's not really a very hard thing, but so that's good.
Well, we all need as adults a literal playground. Do you want to play? I mean, that's the easiest thing for kids, and we don't have playgrounds.
You know? Are you as excited to play as I am?
Right. Well, now, you know, the modern way is to arrange play dates, you know, and figure it out. And it's kind of nice because God and Sayla arranged a play date for us. It's pretty convenient.
Yeah.
Like that. I think that that's been one of the easiest things, is to come together with this paramount purpose in supporting and loving her. And it gives us all like a good reason to be in proximity occasionally and regularly communicating with one another, and then just happily finding out we get along and we'd be friends anyway, mm-hmm. You know, like not happily finding out, like shock and awe.
Yeah.
Like, I cannot believe how well we get along. And we've talked about before, like Alicia's an only child and she's always wanted a sibling.
Mm-hmm.
And I am not an only child, but I've had so much bottled up sister energy that my sister's been like, no thanks, for so long. And God, that's just one of the long list of ways that God has just
redeemed,
creatively redeemed, and just beyond and above our hopes and desires and expectations and imaginations. The fact that I feel this way toward Alicia, and she reciprocates that feeling, like she wants to have a close relationship that's sistery, you know, she like, it's amazing. It's really amazing. So, I mean, I'm not saying like you should contact the birth family because then you'll have a sister friend, like,
right.
You may not, I don't know. I want to encourage people to be open to God's bigger idea.
Mm-hmm. A family.
Because he has one, he's working it.
Mm-hmm.
He's really working it, so.
Yeah.
And like every adoption story is different. Every, you know, biological family relationship is going to be different. I mean, I think that's why, I'm sure you agree with this, Jason, like it is so cool to hear everyone's adoption story because everyone is unique. Every single one is unique. And it's just how creative God is and just how, you know, obvious it is that he loves adoption. And with every adoption story, there's pain and brokenness, but there's also joy and love. You know, it's this paradigm of both, but I think that's what makes a beautiful story too. So.
Absolutely.
That's what all of God's stories are.
Yeah.
You know, real dramatic.
Yeah.
Well, let me kind of close this out with this question. What is one thing you wish everyone knew about adoption?
I don't know. I think for me, the thing that comes to my mind is there's no soundbite sentence. There's no fact I wish people knew about adoption. Those facts are available. Those posters are made. I used to work in at a nonprofit homeless pregnant women's shelter for a while, and the adoption rate was abysmally low. And it was after working there for a while, I realized why. It wasn't information. We were educating women about it. It was cultural. It was cultural in that subculture of that clientele. Most of the women, the vast majority, over 95%, believed that they were not loving their babies if they placed them for adoption, that they were abdicating the most important emblem of their responsibility. You know, the image of their responsibility that they could, if they placed that baby for adoption, then it wasn't loving. They couldn't live with themselves if they did it. And once I finally got that cultural message, oh, that's why. I realized for me, it's adoption isn't more, I believe now, adoption is not more prevalent than it is, not because of missing facts or information, but largely because of culture, what people believe about it, because the stakes couldn't be higher, and because it messes with, I think, what a lot of people in their heart of hearts I shouldn't say people, I'll personalize it, because I definitely am not outside of this. We all have an image. We all have a self-image that we project, a certain way our life looks. And even if people are working very hard and with a lot of self-awareness about being genuine in that projected image to the world, it is an image, you know? We don't have to go all the way to Facebook to be able to identify with that. And I think for some reason, adoption to a lot of people and a lot of subcultures is not positive and not loving. And that's what I wish could shift. That's what I wish. And I don't know. I don't think like a rubber armband and a parade or a 5K is really going to do that. I don't know what it is. And I hate to not offer solutions. But I think that's really what we're up against. It's just like following Christ. You don't really get it until you live it, until mm-hmm. you do it, until mm-hmm. until you get skin in the game. And that doesn't necessarily mean adopt a child. It just means you don't do it until you do it. You don't understand. And so no amount of churchy language can really prepare somebody for what it's like to know Christ personally. And I think adoption is the same. You can't really understand how loving it is until your heart's involved. So I mean, that's what I wish could be known about it. But even in my own saying about it, it's not like I'm saying we can't know it until mm-hmm. we know it. So that's not, I know what you're looking for. I was like, not a, you know, one, it's not a statistic, but mm-hmm. that's how I feel about it.
Yeah.
Oh, what about you? Do you have a solution for it?
No, I have the same, you know, working at a pregnancy center. I just, you know, yeah, it's the hardest option, parenting option to talk about. And, you know, I know that First Look is working with, you know, TBHC to just better be trained on the language and how to talk to a client about adoption. But I think ultimately it's just so, I think of the word adoption is it's like in line with the word marriage or the word baptism, like it's sacred. And those things are supernatural. And so, it's like only of the Lord, only God could ordain an adoption and put that on all the people involved, all their, you know, the birth mom or dad's hearts and the adoptive parents' hearts and bring them together and, you know, all the intricacies that have to like be perfectly in place for it to happen. But I guess what I was going to say is what I want people to know about adoption is that, you know, it is a risk. Like you can't deny that. It is a risk for everyone involved, but it is worth the risk. It is worth the risk because humans are always worth risk. We're God's precious creation and the relationships and people are worth the risk. And I guess I just see like, as it's been obvious in our story, like, you know, Selah may be the pebble that started the ripples in this story, but the ripples are still going. I mean, even we're making ripples today of people that this story is going to touch. And so, it's just worth the risk. It's a beautiful thing. I just feel honored, privileged. I don't know how many more synonyms I could use that God allowed part of my story and my life to include adoption. Like, it's one of the things that I'm most proud of in my life that I get to be a part of one of his adoption stories.
Well, I love it, guys. This was an amazing experience for me. I loved hearing every bit of your story. So let me individually thank you. Dana, thank you so much for just sharing your heart with us today. I'm overwhelmed by the perspective you brought to the story today.
Thank you for having me.
Alicia, thank you very much. Just thank you for the relationship that we've been building, just locally, but also just you sharing your story today.
Thank you. Thank you for asking me to do this. And I just pray that it'll encourage other people out there.
Thank you for joining us. If you would like to get in touch with today's guest or any of our previous guests, you can contact us through our email, podcast@tbhc.org. That's podcast@tbhc.org. Leave us a comment, recommend a guest to our show, and give us a 5-star review wherever you listen. And don't forget to subscribe. For more information, check out our website, tbhc.org, and discover how you can participate in bringing kids home.